with the wolf at her heels and the horses pulling the pole drags following close behind, Ayla was euphoric. She was with the ones she loved most and could hardly believe the man beside her would soon be her mate. She remembered only too well her feelings during the similar trek they had made with the lion camp. Then she had felt that every step she took brought her closer to an inevitable destiny she did not want. She had promised to mate a man she truly cared for and might have been happy with if she hadn't met and loved Jondalar first. But Jondalar had become distant, didn't seem to love her anymore, and there was no doubt that Rainik not only loved her, but wanted her desperately. Ayla had no such adverse feelings now. She was so filled with happiness she felt sure it overflowed and suffused the air around her, permeating the ground she walked upon. Jondalar was also remembering the trip to the Mamutoi summer meeting. The problem had been his jealousy and his fear of facing his people with a woman who might not be acceptable. He had resolved his problems and was no less full of joy than she. Then he had been sure Ayla was lost to him forever, but here she was beside him, and every time he looked at her, she looked back at him with eyes full of love. They followed the trail across the level highland that took them to another viewpoint at the cliff's edge, where they had stopped when they were there alone. Before they crossed the small stream, they paused to watch the thin waterfall dropping over the edge into the river directly below. The people of the cave had spread out across the high field, some making their own trail. The walkers took with them only what they could carry, though packs could be heavy, and some planned to go back to get a second load, usually of items they wanted to trade. Ayla and Jondalar had talked to Joharan and offered to the cave the hauling services of the two horses. The leader spoke to several people, but he decided to load up the horses with meat from the recent deer and bison hunts. When he originally planned the hunts, he had expected that several people would need to make an extra trip back to the ninth cave to bring the meat to the site of the summer meeting. Using the horses saved them the trouble, and for the first time he realized that trained horses could be more than a novelty. They could be useful. Even the help they had provided on the hunt and Jondalar's fast trip back to the ninth cave to tell Zelandani and Chevenar's mate about the tragic accident had not given him the full awareness of their potential benefit. He understood better when he and several others were saved a trek back to the ninth cave, but with the horses traveling so close, he also became aware that the animals required extra work. Winnie was used to the pole drag. She had pulled a travois during most of their journey. Racer was less accustomed to hauling a load and was more unmanageable. Joharan had seen that his brother had to work with the horse, especially turning on the trail where the poles restricted his movement. It required patience to keep the young stallion calm and lead him around obstacles while maintaining the load intact. At the ninth cave, Ayla and Jondalar had started out near the front of the group, but by the time they crossed the small stream and angled northwest again, they were closer to the middle. They reached the place where Ayla and Jondalar had turned back before, where the path began to descend. This time they followed it as it twisted and turned along the easiest grade, winding through brush, open grassland, and in a protected dip, trees. They reached a rock shelter that was so close to the water, part of it extended over the water. They had traveled just under 2 miles in actual distance, though the steep climbs made the journey longer. The shelter had a front porch that was so close to the edge of the river, a person could dive into water from it. The shelter was called Riverfront and faced south. It extended from west to east, all the way to a southward-turning meander of the river that swung back around on itself so close it would have joined at the neck of the loop it formed if it hadn't been for the finger of highland between. Though it appeared to be a habitable shelter, no cave lived there, though travelers, especially those on rafts, sometimes stopped off. The water was a little too close, and it sometimes overflowed into the shelter when the river flooded. The ninth cave didn't stop at riverfront, but climbed back up the cliff behind the shelter. The trail continued north, then curved around toward the east. About a mile after leaving riverfront, the trail headed down a fairly steep grade to the valley of a small stream that was usually dry in summer. After crossing the muddy stream bed, Joharan stopped, and everybody rested while he waited for Jandalar and Ayla. Several people made small fires to boil water for a hot tea. Some took out traveling food, especially those with children, and had a snack.
"We need to make a choice here, Jandalar," Joharan said. "Which way do you think we should go?"
Because the river meandered through its valley, crowding close to cliff walls on first one side and then the other, it was sometimes easier to travel between caves across the highlands. To reach the next site, however, there was another possibility.
"From here there are two ways we can go," Jandalar said. "If we follow this trail across the top of the cliffs, we'll have to climb up this slope, go across the highland for about half the distance we've already come, then go down again until we come to another little stream. It usually has water, but it's shallow and easy to cross. Then we have another steep climb that traverses the front of the cliff overlooking the river, then down again. The river runs through the middle of a large grassy field there, the floodplain. We'll stop and visit with the 29th cave, probably overnight."
"But there's another way to go," Joharan said. "The 29th cave is called Three Rocks because they have three shelters, not right next to each other, but spaced around the river and the large floodplain. Two of them are on this side, the third is on the other side of the river."
Joharan pointed to the slope ahead.
"Instead of climbing this, we can turn east to the river. It turns north ahead, and you have to cross to the other side because the water runs right next to the cliffs on this side. But there's a long, shallow stretch that's easy to get across, and the 29th cave keeps stepping stones there, as we do at the crossing. We go along the other side for a while, then the river turns east again and crowds the cliffs on the other side, so you have to cross back over, but it spreads out and gets shallow again, and that crossing also has stepping stones. We can stop at two of the shelters on this side to visit, but we have to cross over again to get to the third and biggest one, because that is probably where we'll stay, especially if it rains.
If we go that way, we have to climb. If we go this way, we have to cross running water,"
Jandalar finished for him.
"What do you think would be the best way with the horses and the pole drags?"
"It's easy to cross rivers with the horses, but if it's very deep, the meat on the pole drags can get wet, which means it could spoil if it's not dried out again," Ayla said. "On our journey, we had the poles attached to the bowl boat, so it always floated up when we had to cross rivers. But didn't you say we have to cross the river at least once anyway?"
Jandalar walked behind Racer's pole drag.
"I was thinking, Joharan, if we can get a couple of people to walk back here behind the horses and lift up the ends of the poles just enough to keep them out of the water, I think we could get across without getting anything wet."
"I'm sure we could find people to do that. There are always a few young men who like to splash through the water whenever there's a crossing anyway. I'll go ask around,"
Joharan said.
"I think most people would rather not climb any more than they have to, with the loads they're all carrying."
When Joharan left, Jandalar decided to check Racer's lead rope. He stroked the horse, gave him some grain that he had in a pouch. Ayla smiled at him. She was paying attention to Wolf, who came to see why they stopped. She felt the special bond she and Jandalar had formed on their journey. Then it occurred to her that they had another. They were the only people who understood the connection that could develop between a person and an animal.
"There is another way to go up river. Well, two more,"
Jandalar said while they were waiting.
"One is to pole up by raft, but I don't think that would work too well with the horses. The other is to go along the top of the cliffs on the other side of the river. You have to take the crossing, and it's actually easier to go all the way to the third cave and start from there. They have a good path to the top of Two Rivers Rock that continues as a trail across the highland. It's more level than this side, only a few minor dips,
There aren't as many tributaries on that side of the river, but if you plan to stop at the 29th cave, you have to come down and cross the river again. That's why Joharan decided to stay on this side.
While they rested, Ayla asked about the people they were going to visit. Jandalar described the unusual arrangement of the people of the 29th cave of the Zelandanyi. Three rocks consisted of three separate settlements of stone shelters in three separate cliffs that formed a triangle around the floodplain of the meandering river, all within a mile and a half of each other.
The histories say that they used to be separate caves, numbered with earlier counting words, and there were more than three,
Jandalar explained.
But they all had to share the same field and rivers, and they were always disputing rights, arguing about which cave could use what and when. I guess it got rather bitter. Some men actually started fighting with each other. Then the Zelandani of South Face got the idea to join together into one cave, work together, and share everything. If a herd of aurochs migrated through, it wouldn't be the hunters of all the different caves going after them separately, but one hunting party from all the caves working together.
Ayla thought for a while. But the 9th cave works together with neighboring caves. On that last hunt, the hunters from the 11th, the 14th, the 3rd, the 2nd, and a few people from the 7th all hunted together, and everyone shared the food.
That's true, but all of our caves don't have to share everything, Jandalar said. The 9th cave has Wood River Valley, and animals sometimes move along the river right in front of the porch. The 14th has Little Valley. The 11th can raft to a big field right across the river. The 3rd has Grass Valley, and the 2nd and 7th share Sweet Valley. When we get back, we'll go and visit them. We can all work together when we want, but we don't have to. All the caves that joined to become the 29th had to share the same hunting area. They now call it Three Rocks Valley, but it is a part of the River Valley and North River Valley.
He explained that the river took an eastward turn, cutting through the middle of the large grassy floodplain. It was joined on the north by a healthy tributary and its valley. Two of the settlements were on the right bank of the river, the one to the west that could be reached overland from riverfront, and another to the north. A third massive cliff with several stories of rock shelters was to the south, across the river on the left bank. It was one of the few inhabited rock shelters with a north-facing front. The western settlement, or the west holding of the 29th cave of the Zelandanyi, consisted of several small rock shelters in the side of a hill. Jandalar told her they also maintained a more or less permanent campsite of lean-tos, fireplaces, and drying racks, and in summer, tents and other temporary shelters near west holding. It was at the opening of a sheltered valley of stone pines, whose pine-nut-filled cones were a source of vegetable oil so rich it could be burned in lamps, though it was so delicious it was seldom used for that purpose. People from the entire community of Three Rocks, and others that were invited to help in return for a share, gathered for the pine-nut harvest. That was the primary purpose for the outdoor camp. But it was also near a very good fishing spot that lent itself to fish traps and weirs. It was used quite often by the community all through the warmer part of the year, and usually not closed down until the freeze stilled the river for the winter. Though people lived in the various rock shelters of West Holding all year, and the nut harvest, which was the original reason the campsite was established, was in autumn, the first tents went up at the beginning of the warm season to work the fish traps, and everyone always talked about going to summer camp. The western settlement came to be known as summer camp.
"There Zelandani is a good artist," Jandalar said. "In one of the shelters she has engraved animals on the walls. Maybe we'll have time to visit her. She makes small carvings to carry, too. But we'll be back here for the nut harvest anyway."
Joharan returned with three young men and one young woman, who had volunteered to walk behind the travois and lift the poles out of the water when they crossed rivers.
They all seemed rather pleased to have been chosen to perform the task. Joharan had no trouble finding people who were willing. The problem was making the selection. Many people wanted to get closer to the horses and the wolf and learn more about the foreign woman. It would give them something interesting to talk about at the summer meeting. On the more level terrain, except during the actual water crossings, Jandalar and Ayla were able to walk side by side, leading the horses. Wolf, as usual, did not follow as closely. He liked to explore when he traveled, running ahead and falling behind, following his curiosity and the scents his sensitive nose detected. Jandalar used the opportunity to tell Ayla more about the people they would be staying with and their territory. He talked about the large tributary coming down from the north called North River that joined the river on the right bank. The northern side of the grassy floodplain that was enlarged by North River's valley, as well as by the continually expanding upstream valley of the river itself. Jutting out between the valleys of the tributary and the primary was the oldest living site of the community, the Northern Settlement, formerly the north holding of the 29th cave of the Zelandanyi, but referred to as South Face. To reach it from summer camp, he told her, they used a path that led to stepping stones across the tributary, but now they were approaching it along the river. Ahead, on a hill overlooking the open landscape, was a triangular-shaped cliff that held three south-facing terraces arranged like steps, one over the other. Though it was within a mile and a half of all the living sites that made up the Three Rocks community, several auxiliary sites were much closer and now considered themselves part of the north holding of the 29th cave. He explained that a well-used trail traversed easily up the hillside in two switchbacks to the middle level, which was the main living site of South Face. The upper small abri, which overlooked much of the large valley, was used as a lookout and was usually referred to as the South Face Overlook, or simply the Overlook. The lowest level was semi-subterranean and used more for storage than everyday living. Among other food and supplies, the nuts collected at summer camp were kept there. Some of the other abri that were part of the South Face settlement complex had their own descriptive names, such as Long Rock, Deep Bank, and Good Spring, referring to the natural spring that welled up nearby.
"Even the storage area has a name," Jandalar said. "It's called Bear Rock. The old people tell the story that was told to them when they were young. It's part of the histories. It's about a very hard winter and a cold, wet spring when they ran out of all their stored food. The lower rock storage area was bare rock. Then the last gasp of winter howled in with a driving blizzard. Everyone went hungry for a while. The only thing that saved them from starvation was a large cache of pine nuts stored by squirrels in the lower rock shelter that a young girl happened to find. It's amazing how much those little nut chasers can pile up. But even when the weather cleared enough to hunt, the deer and horses they managed to kill had been starving too," Jandalar continued. "The meat was lean and tough, and it was a long time before the first greens and roots of spring. The next fall, the whole community gathered many more of the nuts from the stone pines as a hedge against future hard winters and hungry springs, and started the tradition of collecting them. The young people who had helped them keep the food dry while crossing rivers crowded in close so they could hear Jandalar as he talked about their closest neighbor to the north. They didn't know that much about them either, and listened with interest. About a mile and a half away and across the river, they could see the south holding of the 29th cave of the Zelandanyi, the largest and most unusual cliff in the region. Though north-facing sites were seldom utilized as living spaces, this one on the south side of the river was too inviting to be ignored. The cliff face, a half mile in length, rose vertically 250 feet from the river in five levels and held nearly 100 caves and cavities, plus overhanging rock shelters and terraces.
grand views of the valley could be seen from all the terraces, so a specific shelter or cave to use as a lookout was not needed. But the cliff did offer a different, unique view. In one section of a lower terrace that projected over a quiet backwater of the moving stream, it was possible to look down and see one's reflection in the still water.
"It's not named for its size, as you might think,"
Jandalar said.
"It's named for that unusual view. It's called Reflection Rock."
The cliff was so huge that most of the possible living sites were not even occupied. It would have been as crowded as a marmot mound if they had been. The natural resources of the surrounding area would not have supported so many people. They would have depleted whole herds and stripped the landscape of vegetation. But the huge cliff was an exceptional place, and those who lived there knew that the mere sight of their home left strangers and first-time visitors gaping with awe. It could even dazzle those who were familiar with it, Jandalar realized, as he looked at the extraordinary natural formation. The ninth cave, with its magnificent overhanging stone shelf sheltering a spacious and comfortable area, was certainly remarkable in its own right, and in most ways offered more livability. That it primarily faced south was a tremendous advantage. But he had to admit that the extensive and imposing cliff ahead was impressive. The people who were standing on the lowest level terrace were feeling a touch of awe themselves at the sight that was approaching them. The welcoming gesture of the woman who was standing somewhat ahead of the others was more tentative than usual. She was holding her hand up with her palm facing her, but her beckoning motion was not very vigorous. She had heard of the return of Marthona's wandering second son and the foreign woman he brought back. She had even heard that they had horses and a wolf with them. But hearing it was not the same as seeing it, and seeing two horses walking calmly amid the people of the ninth cave behind a wolf, a big wolf, a tall, blonde, unfamiliar woman and the man she knew as Jandalar, was unnerving, at the very least. Joharan looked aside to cover up a smile he couldn't help making when he saw the woman's expression, though he understood entirely how she felt. It wasn't so long ago that he had experienced the same frisson of fear at the same uncanny sight. He was amazed, when he thought about it, how quickly he had gotten used to it. So quickly that he hadn't anticipated the reaction of his neighbors, and he knew he should have. He was glad they had stopped. It gave him a hint of the effect they would very likely have on people when they reached the summer meeting. Chapter 22. If Joharan hadn't decided to set up the tent in the field, I think I would have stayed out anyway, Ayla said. I want to be close to Winnie and Racer while we're traveling, and I didn't want to bring them up on that cliff. They wouldn't have liked it.
I don't think Dinanna would have liked it much either,
Jandalar said.
She seemed exceptionally nervous around the animals.
They were riding upstream through the valley of the tributary called North River, giving the animals and themselves a break from the close association of so many people. They had gone through the formality of meeting all the leaders, and Ayla was still trying to sort them out. Dinanna, who was the leader of Reflection Rock, the South Holding, was the acknowledged leader of the 29th Cave, but Summer Camp and South Face, the West and North Holdings, also had leaders. Whenever there were decisions to make which concerned all of Three Rocks, the three leaders worked together to reach a consensus, but it was presented by Dinanna, because the rest of the Zelandanyi leaders insisted that if the 29th cave was going to call itself one cave, then they should have just one leader to speak for them. The Zelandanya had a slightly different set of requirements. West, North, and South Holdings each had their own Zelandani, but the Zelandanya of the three holdings were assistants to a fourth Danyar, who was the Zelandani of the 29th. Because there was a great enough distance between the holdings, it was reasonable that each would want their own Zelandani, and one who was a good healer, especially during the seasons of cold and stormy weather.
But the primary relationship of any individual Zelandani was to the Zelandania as a whole, although the cave they served was of almost equal and in some ways greater importance. The Zelandani of Reflection Rock was such a good healer that even women during childbirth were glad to have him assist. The Zelandani of the 29th, who also lived at Reflection Rock to be close to the nominal leader, was not a particularly good healer, but she was a good mediator who could work diplomatically with the three other Zelandania and the three leaders and soothe the sometimes prickly feelings of all of them. Some people felt that if it were not for Zelandani of the 29th, the whole complex arrangement called the 29th Cave would not hold together. Ayla was happy to have the excuse of the horses needing care and attention to get away from the rest of the formal greetings, feasting, and other rituals. She had spoken to Joharan and Proliva before meeting their neighbors of the next cave to the north, and told them it was essential for the well-being of Whinny and Racer that she and Jandalar tend to them. The leader said he would make their excuses, and the leader's mate promised to save some food for them. Ayla was conscious of being watched while they unhitched the pole drags and removed the rest of the loads, and when she examined both horses carefully to make sure they had not sustained any injuries or developed any sores. They rubbed down and combed both animals. Then Jandalar suggested that they take Whinny and Racer out and let them run after the day of slow and careful walking. Ayla's beautiful smile of gratitude made him glad he had. Wolf leaped ahead when he saw them heading out. He seemed pleased, too. Joharan was among those who watched them with the horses. He had often seen them doing the same thing before, but this time he understood it as one more element of the care they required. Horses obviously didn't need that kind of attention when they were living with their herds, but when they did the work that people wanted, perhaps they did. Yes, the potential benefit of using horses to help in various ways was there, but was it worth the amount of work they required? It was a question he was pondering while he watched Ayla and his brother ride off. Ayla felt herself relax almost as soon as they left. There was a sense of release, of freedom, to riding away by themselves. They had grown accustomed to traveling together with just the animals on their long journey, and they both found respite in returning to their habit. When they reached the North River Valley and saw the long open grassland ahead, they looked at each other simultaneously, grinned, then urged the horses on until they were galloping across the field full tilt. They didn't notice when they passed a couple of people returning to the 29th Cave from a quick trip to the site of the summer meeting, but the people noticed them. They stared with mouths agape at a sight they had never seen before and weren't sure they wanted to see again. People racing along on the backs of horses left them uneasy. Ayla stopped beside a small creek. Jandalar pulled up at the next step. With tacit agreement, they both turned and followed it. The source was a spring-fed pool with a large willow hovering over it, as though protecting its birthright of water for itself and its offspring. A collection of smaller willows crowding close to the large, overflowing basin. They dismounted, took the riding baskets off the horses, and spread them out on the ground. The horses drank from the creek. Then both of them decided it was a good time for a roll. The young couple couldn't help laughing at the animals squirming on their backs with their legs in the air, feeling comfortable and safe enough to enjoy a good back scratch. Suddenly Ayla reached for the sling wrapped around her head, unwrapped it quickly, and glanced down toward the pool for stones. She grabbed a couple of rounded pebbles, fit one into the pocket of the hurling weapon, and let it fly. Without looking, she grabbed the leather strap again, pulled it through her hand to the end, brought both ends together, and had another stone ready to go, just as a second bird was taking to the air. She brought it down, then went to retrieve her two willow ptarmigan. "If it was just the two of us, and we were going to set up camp here, we'd have our evening meal," Ayla said, holding up her trophies.
"But it's not just the two of us. So what are you going to do with them?
Jandalar said. Well, the feathers of the ptarmigan are the warmest and lightest, and the feather markings are rather nice this time of year. I could make something for the baby, she said. But I'll have time to make baby things later. I think I'll give these to Dinanna. After all, this is their territory, and she seems so anxious about Winnie and Racer and Wolf that I think she wishes we hadn't come. Maybe a gift will make her feel better.
Where did you learn to be so wise, Ayla?
Jandalar said, looking at her with love and warmth. That's not wisdom. That's just sense, Jandalar. She looked up and felt herself become lost in the magic of his eyes. The only place she had ever seen such a rich blue color was in the deep pools of glaciers, but his eyes were not icy. They were warm and full of love. He put his arms around her, and she dropped the brace of birds to reach up and kiss him. It seemed like a long time since he had held her like this. Then she realized it had been a long time, not since he had kissed her, but since they had been alone in an open field, with the horses grazing contentedly, and Wolf poking his inquiring nose into every bush and hole in the ground, and no one else around. Soon they would have to go back and continue the trek to the summer meeting, and who knew when they would have a moment like this again? When Jandalar began nuzzling her neck, Ayla responded eagerly. His warm breath and moist tongue sent shivers through her, and she gave herself to them, letting the sensation overcome her. He blew in her ear and nibbled her lobe, then pulled his hands forward to hold the fullness of her breasts. Even more full now, he thought, reminding him that she was carrying new life inside her, new life that she said was as much his as hers. At the least, the life had to be of his spirit. Of that he felt sure. For most of their journey, he had been the only man around for the mother to take an elan from. She untied her waist-thong, from which hung various objects and pouches that were secured by loops or strings, and laid it down beside the riding blanket, making sure all the things that were attached to it stayed in place. He sat down on the edge of the leather covering that smelled strongly, though not unpleasantly, of horse. It was a smell he was used to, and that carried with it enjoyable associations. Quickly he began untying and unwrapping the thongs of his foot coverings from around his legs, then stood up and untied the waistband that held closed the overlapping front of his leggings and pulled them off. When he looked up, Ayla had done the same. He looked at her and liked what he saw. Her shape was more full. Not only her breasts, but her stomach, which was rounder, starting to show the new life growing. He felt his manhood respond, snatched off his tunic, then helped Ayla with hers. He felt a cool breeze on his bare skin, saw chill bumps raise on hers, and took her in his arms, feeling her warmth and trying to keep her that way. "I'm going to wash in the pool," she said. He smiled, feeling that it was an invitation for him to pleasure her the way he liked.
"You don't have to," he said.
"I know, but I want to. All the walking and climbing made me sweaty," she said, walking toward the pond. It was cold, but she usually washed in cold water and found the chill, tingling sensation stimulating most of the time. In the mornings it woke her up. It was a shallow pond except for the end near the spring. There she found it dropped off quickly until her feet no longer touched the rocky, silty bottom. She treaded water, moving out of the deep part and back toward the stony bank. Jandalar followed her in, though he liked cold water far less than she did. He was up to his thighs, and when she got close, he splashed her. She squealed and sloshed the water around, roiling it up, and with both hands splashed a wave toward him that caught him in the face and soaked him from the shoulders down.
"I wasn't ready for that," he said,
sputtering with a sudden shiver, and slapped the water back at her. The horses looked up at the commotion they were making in the water. She grinned at him, he reached for her, and the noisy water play stopped as they stood together with arms entwined and lips pressed together.
Maybe I should help you wash, he murmured in her ear as he reached between her legs and felt himself respond.
Maybe I should help you,
she said, reaching for his hard, erect member, and with the water she rubbed her hand up and down, exposing the head from the foreskin. The cold liquid ought to have cooled his ardor, he thought, but her cool hand on his warm organ was strangely, intensely stimulating. Then she knelt down, and when she took the head of his manhood in her mouth, it felt hot. He moaned as she moved back and forth, working her tongue around the head, and he felt such urgency it caught him by surprise. Suddenly, before he could control it, he felt his ardor rise and burst forth as waves of release washed through him. He pushed her back.
"Let's get out of this cold water," he said.
She spit out his essence and rinsed her mouth, then smiled at him. Taking her hand, he led her out. When they reached the riding blanket, they sat down. Then he pushed her back and lay down beside her, raising up on an arm to look at her.
"You caught me by surprise," he said,
feeling relaxed but slightly flustered. It had not turned out the way he had planned. She smiled. It wasn't often that he gave up his essence so quickly. He was always the one who liked to maintain control. Her smile turned to a grin of delight.
"You must have been more ready than you thought," she said.
"You don't have to look so pleased with yourself," he said.
"It's not often that I can surprise you," she said. "You are the one who knows me so well. It surprises me and always makes me feel so pleasured."
He couldn't help but smile back at her delight. He leaned over to kiss her, and she opened her mouth slightly, welcoming him. He enjoyed touching her, holding her, kissing her in any case. He probed inside her mouth, gently, tentatively, and she did the same. Then he felt just the hint of an urge start to rise again and felt pleased. He might not be entirely spent yet, and there was no hurry to get back. He spent time just kissing her, then running his tongue over her lips. He found her neck and her throat, nibbling and kissing them. It tickled, and she had to restrain herself to keep from moving aside. She was already stimulated, and holding herself still added to the experience. When he started to move lower, kissing her shoulder and her inner arm all the way to the elbow, she could hardly stand it and wanted more at the same time. Without her realizing it, her breathing increased, which encouraged him. Then, suddenly, he took a nipple in his mouth, and she gasped as streaks of fire flashed inside to her inner place. His manhood was growing again. He felt the roundness of her breast, then took the contracted, upright nipple of her other breast in his mouth and suckled hard. He reached for the first nipple with his hand, squeezing and manipulating it between his fingers. She pushed against him, feeling the intensity and wanting more. She did not hear the breeze in the willows or feel the coolness of the air. Her entire attention was focused inside on the sensations he caused her to feel. He, too, was feeling the heat rise inside himself and his tumescent manhood. He moved lower, settled himself between her thighs, and opening her folds, bent down for his first sample. She was still wet from the water, and he reveled in the cold and the wet and the warmth and the salt and the familiar taste of Ayla, his Ayla. He wanted all of her, all at once, and reached up for her nipples as he found her hard, pulsing nodule. She moaned and cried out, arching up to him as he suckled and manipulated her with his tongue. She was not thinking, just feeling. Then, before she knew it, she was there, feeling the surge grow and expand until suddenly it washed over her as he felt the wetness. Then she was reaching for him, making little cries of need, wanting to feel him inside her. He rose up, found her opening, and pushed himself in, then pulled his manhood out and pushed in again. She was meeting him, pushing closer and pulling back, arching and turning her body to feel him just where she needed him. His urge was there, but not quite as demanding as it sometimes was. Rather than having to control, he just let it build,
rocking with her, moving with her, feeling the tension grow, plunging deeply with joy and abandon. She was calling out, and her wordless sounds gained in pitch and intensity. Then it reached the peak, and with words and sounds increasing, they felt a great release swell up and gush forth. They held for a moment, then pushed in and pulled out a few more times, and lay still, panting to catch their breath. As she lay there with her eyes closed, Ayla heard the wind soughing through the trees and a bird calling to its mate, felt the cool breeze and the delicious feeling of his weight on her, smelled horse from the blanket and the scent of their pleasures, and remembered the taste of his skin and his kisses. When he finally pulled himself up and looked at her, she was smiling, a dreamy, half-dozing, warm smile of contentment. When they finally got up, Ayla went back into the pond to clean herself, as Issa had taught her long ago. Jandalar did, too. It seemed to him that if she did, he ought to, though it hadn't been his habit until he met her. He really didn't like the cold water. As he was rinsing off, however, he thought if there were many more days like today, he could learn to like it. On the way back to the south holding of the 29th cave, Ayla found she was not looking forward to seeing the neighbors, which seemed somewhat inimical. Though she felt accepted by Jandalar's kin and the members of the 9th cave, she realized she wasn't especially eager to see them either. As much as she had wanted their journey to come to an end and to have the company of other people around her, she had grown used to the pattern she and Jandalar had established while they were traveling, and she missed them. When they were with the cave, there was always someone who wanted to talk to either Jandalar or her or both. They were both glad for the close warmth of the people, but sometimes young lovers wanted to be alone. In their sleeping rolls in the family tent that night, with everyone much closer together, Ayla was reminded of the sleeping arrangements within the Mamutoi Earth Lodge, and found herself thinking about them. When she first saw it, she had been amazed at the semi-subterranean longhouse the lion camp had constructed. They used mammoth bones to support the thick walls of sod and thatch covered by clay, which kept out the intense wind and winter cold of the mid-continental periglacial regions. She remembered thinking that it was as if they had built their own cave. In a sense they had, since there were no habitable caves in their region, and she was right to be amazed. It was a remarkable feat. Though the families that lived in the longhouse of the lion camp had had separate living areas around hearths aligned in a row down the center and drapes to close off their sleeping platforms, everyone shared the same shelter. They lived less than an arm's length away from the next family and had to pass through each other's living space to come and go. In order to live in such a confined space, they practiced a tacit courtesy that allowed privacy and was learned as they grew up. Ayla hadn't thought the Earth Lodge was small when she lived there, only since she had begun sleeping in the 9th cave's huge shelter. She recalled that each family of the clan had had separate hearths, too, but there were no walls, only a few stones to indicate boundaries. The people of the clan also learned early to avoid looking into another family's living space. To them, privacy was a matter of convention and consideration. Though the dwellings of the Zelandanyi had walls, they did not keep out sounds, of course. Their homes did not have to be as sturdily built as the earth lodges of the Mamutoi. Their natural shelters of stone protected them from most of the elements. The Zelandanyi structures primarily conserved heat inside and blocked winds that strayed under the overhanging cliff shelf. Walking through the living area under the abris, snatches of conversation could often be heard from inside each home, but the Zelandanyi learned to ignore the voices of their neighbors. It was like the people of the clan, who learned not to see into the neighboring hearth and the unspoken courtesy of the Mamutoi. Thinking about it, Ayla realized that in the short time she had lived there, she had already learned not to hear people from the neighboring dwellings anymore, most of the time. As the young couple were snuggling together, with Wolf beside them, hearing quiet murmurs from the other sleeping rolls, Ayla said, "I like the Zalindanyi way of making a separate dwelling for each family, Jandalar, of having a home apart from others."
"I'm glad you do," he said, feeling even more pleased with himself for making arrangements to have a home ready for her when they returned from the summer meeting, and for keeping it a secret so he could surprise her with it.
As she closed her eyes, Ayla was thinking about having her own dwelling some day, with walls. To her, the walls of the Zalindanyi dwelling afforded a measure of privacy unknown to the clan, or even to the Mamutoi. The internal partitions enlarged on that privacy. Although she had been lonely, Ayla had learned to enjoy her solitude in her valley, and traveling alone with Jandalar had reinforced her desire to put something between herself and other people. But the closeness of the dwellings gave her the security of knowing that there was always someone nearby. If she wanted to, she could still hear the comforting sounds of people settling down for the night, sounds she had heard all her life, low voices talking, a baby's cry, a couple making love. She had hungered for those sounds when she lived alone, but in the ninth cave there was also a place to get off by oneself. Once inside the thin walls of each dwelling, it was easy to forget that anyone else was around, but the undercurrent of background sounds gave her a fundamental feeling of security. She thought the way the Zalindanyi lived was just right. When they started out the next morning, Ayla noticed that their number had grown. Many people from the 29th cave had joined them, though not, she noticed, the people from Reflection Rock, or at least none she recognized. When she mentioned the increase to Joharan, he said most of the summer camp, nearly half of South Face, and a few from Reflection Rock would be traveling with them. The rest would start out in the next day or so. She recalled that Jandalar had mentioned something about returning to summer camp to help with the pine nut harvest, and got the impression that the ninth cave had closer ties with West Holding than with the other holdings of the 29th cave. From Reflection Rock, as they proceeded along the river upstream, they would first head due north at the beginning of a broad bend that curved around to the east, then curved south and east again, making a second large loop that ended up going north again, making an extensive S-curve. The waterway then continued with easier meandering curves toward the northeast. There were a few small stone shelters at the northern end of the first loop that were used as temporary stopping places when people were traveling or hunting. But the next settlement was at the southernmost end of the second loop, where a small stream joined the river through Old Valley, the home of the fifth cave of the Zalindanyi. Unless they were traveling by raft, which required poling upstream for almost 10 miles, it was easier to reach Old Valley from Reflection Rock by going directly cross-country rather than following the river around the generous bend to the north and back again. Overland, the home of the fifth cave was only a little more than 3 miles east and somewhat north, though the trail itself, taking the easiest way across the hilly terrain, was not quite so direct. When Joharan came to the head of the clearly marked trail, he veered away from the river and started up a path that traversed the side of a ridge, then crossed a rounded top where it met the high trail coming from the third cave at Two Rivers Rock, and went down the other side to the level of the river again. As they walked, Ayla was interested in learning more about the fifth cave and decided to try to encourage Jandalar to talk about them.
"If the third cave is known for its hunters, and the people of the 14th cave are recognized as good fishers, what is the fifth cave known for, Jandalar?" she asked.
"I'd say the people of the fifth cave are known for being very self-sufficient."
Ayla noticed that the four young people who had volunteered to lift the travois when they were crossing the river the day before were still traveling near them, and crowded in closer when they heard her question. Though they had lived at the ninth cave all their lives and knew the various neighboring Zelandanyi caves, they had never heard them described so that a stranger would understand them. They were interested in Jandalar's characterizations.
They pride themselves on having skilled hunters, fishers, and experts in every craft,
Jandalar continued.
They even make their own rafts, and say that they were the first cave to make them, though the 11th cave takes exception to that claim. Their Zelandanya and artists have always been well respected. There are deep carvings on the walls of several of their shelters. Others have painted or carved plaques, mostly of bison and horses, because the 5th cave has a special connection with those animals.
Why is this called Old Valley?
Ayla asked.
Because people have lived here longer than most of the other settlements. Their counting number alone shows their age. Only the 2nd and 3rd caves are older than the 5th. The histories of many caves speak of ties to the 5th cave. Most of their wall carvings are so old, they don't really know who made them. One is of 5 animals that was carved by an ancestor so long ago, it's mentioned in the elder legends and is a symbol of their number,
Jandalar said.
And the Zelandanya say 5 is a very sacred number.
What do they mean by sacred?
It has a special meaning to the mother. Ask Zelandani to tell you about the number 5 sometime,
Jandalar said.
What happened to the 1st cave?
Ayla paused for a moment to mentally go through the counting words.
And the 4th cave?
There is a lot about the 1st cave in the histories and elder legends. You'll probably hear more at the summer meeting, but nobody knows what happened to the 4th. Most people think it was a tragedy of some kind. Some think an enemy used an evil Zelandani to cause sickness that made them all die. Others think it might just have been an argument with a bad leader that made most of the people decide to leave and join another cave. But when new people join a cave, it usually becomes part of their history, and no cave's history has any mention of the 4th cave, at least none that are around now,
Jandalar said.
Some people think the number 4 is unlucky, but the 1st says it's not the number, only some of its associations that are unlucky.
After walking a distance of about 4 miles, they climbed a last rise and approached a narrow valley with a lively stream running down the middle and high cliffs rearing up on both sides that offered 8 rock shelters of various sizes. As the big procession with Joharan in the lead started down a trail to the head of Old Valley, 2 men and a woman came up the same trail and met them. After the formality of greetings, they told the travelers that most of the 5th cave had already left for the summer meeting.
"You're welcome to stay, of course, but since it is barely midday, we thought you might want to continue,"
the woman said.
"Who is here?" Joharan asked.
2 oldsters who can't make the trip. One can hardly get out of bed. And a woman who is close to giving birth. Zelandani didn't think it was safe for her to travel. She's had trouble before. And, of course, these 2 hunters. They will stay until the moon is new.
You are 1st acolyte of Zelandani of the 5th, I believe,
the one who was 1st said.
Yes, I am. I stayed to help with the birth.
I thought I recognized you. Is there anything we can do to help?
I don't think so. She's not ready yet. It will be several days, and her mother and aunt stayed, too. She should be fine.
Joharan called for a consultation with people from the 9th cave, as well as from the caves who had joined them.
The best places to set up camp may already be taken, he said. I think we should keep going, rather than stop over here.
The others quickly agreed, and it was decided to push ahead. The river's course straightened out somewhat after the big S-curve as it veered toward the northeast. There were several shelters that were home to small caves along the next stretch of river. All but one had already left for the summer meeting, and that one joined them, falling in behind the party of travelers. Joharan became even more concerned about finding a desirable location for his large cave to settle for the summer. It surprised Ayla that there were so many people in the region and so close together. Like the Zelandanyi, the people she grew up with foraged for all their needs. They gathered, hunted, and fished for their food and clothing, used natural shelters they found, or manufactured protection from the elements, along with their tools and hunting weapons, out of the materials at hand. She understood at a deep intuitive level that if more people lived in a region than its resources could support, there would not be enough at all. Some would either have to move or do without. She realized that the land of the Zelandanyi had to be extremely rich to provide for so many, but in an analytical corner of her mind, she could not help but wonder what would happen to people if things changed. It was the reason the summer meeting was held at a different place every year. Such a large concentration of people depleted the resources of the immediate area, and it would need several years to recover. The meeting this year was not far from the shelter of the ninth cave, perhaps 20 miles upstream if they followed the river closely. But they had saved some of that distance by going more directly cross-country from the 29th cave to the 5th cave. The place they were heading was a little more than 10 miles from Old Valley, and Joharan decided to try to make it without stopping overnight. He thought about calling a meeting to discuss it, to see if he could encourage them to hurry, but there were too many people, of different ages and abilities, and their pace was inevitably going to be as fast as the slowest of them could go. A meeting would just slow them down more. Instead, he thought he would try to push them a little more than usual, without saying anything. If people started to complain, he would worry about stopping then. They did take a break for a midday meal, but when Joharan started out again, people fell in behind him. It was not dark yet, but the sun was definitely going down when the river angled right, close to a sloping hillside on the left bank, their right. They turned inland, away from the river, and ascended a moderate hill along a well-used path. As they climbed, a view of the surrounding countryside opened out, showing a wide panorama for some distance. But when they reached the crest, Ayla caught her breath at the sight of a different view, an enormous horde of people in the valley below. She knew there were already more Zelandanyi here than the total number who had attended the Mamutoi summer meeting, and not everyone had arrived yet. Even if she counted every person she had ever met, she was sure she had never seen so many people, much less all in one place. Though there were not as many, to her, the only sight that came close were the tremendous herds of bison or reindeer that congregated in the thousands each year. But this was a teeming, seething herd of humanity. The group that had started out from the ninth cave had enlarged considerably, but the ones who had joined them along the way quickly dispersed looking for friends and relatives and a place to establish their camp. Zelandani headed for the main camp area where the Zelandanya had their own special lodge in the center of everything. They always played a major role at the summer meeting. Ayla hoped that the ninth cave would find a place somewhat away from the major activities. It would be easier to take the animals out for exercise if they didn't have to be led through crowds of curious people. Jandalar had already spoken to his brother about the needs of the animals and their nervousness around so many people. Joharan had nodded and said he would keep it in mind. But privately, he felt that the needs of the people of the ninth cave were more important than those of the animals. He wanted to be close to the centers of activity, and he hoped to find a spot near a river so it would not be such a burden to carry water. Perhaps close to a tree or two for shade, and not too far from the wooded area that would supply firewood. He knew, however, that the large woods near the encampment would be denuded before the end of the season. Everybody needed firewood. But when he, Soliban, and Rushamar started looking, Joharan quickly realized that the good, close-in spots near the woods and water were already taken. The ninth was a sizable cave with more people than other caves,
They needed more space for their camp, and he wanted to find a place before it got too dark. It forced Joharan to inspect the periphery of the summer meeting area. The large waterway had narrowed around the turn of the last bend, and he'd noticed that the banks were steeper on the downriver side of the campsite, making it harder to reach the water. The three men went back to the river and started walking upstream. After a short distance, they saw a small runoff creek that flowed through a grassy meadow and emptied into the main river, and they turned to follow it. Somewhat back from the river, they noticed an open stand of trees. As they neared, they saw that the woodland was a gallery forest lining both sides of the small stream. They headed into the woods. As they walked along the little stream, Joharan became aware that the creek was curving around the base of a hill, and the wooded area was growing thicker, becoming an actual forest that was bigger and went deeper than it seemed at first. After some time, they came to the source of the creek, a small spring that bubbled up from underground, overhung with trailing branches of willow that were framed by birch, spruce, and a few larch. A deep pool fed by the same source was on the other side of the spring. The entire countryside was full of natural springs, and like many others, this one created a small tributary to the river. Behind the trees on the other side of the pool was a fairly steep rock-strewn slope littered with stones of all sizes, from tiny pebbles to massive boulders. In front of the pool was a grassy glen that led to a small open beach of soil, fine sand, and smooth water-rounded stones, with a screen of dense brush along the near side of the pool. It was an agreeable place, and Joharan thought that if he were by himself or with just a few people, he would set up camp right there. But with a whole cave, they not only needed more room, they needed to be closer to the main campsite. The three men headed back along the creek, and when they reached the meadow beside the river, Joharan stopped.
"What do you think?"
he asked.
"It's a little farther away from everything."
Rushamar dipped his hand in the creek and took a taste of the water. It was cool and fresh.
"This will have good water all summer. You know that by the end of the season, both the stream through the main campsite and the river in front of the camp and downstream will not be fresh and clean anymore."
"And everyone else will be using the big woods for firewood," Soliban said.
"This area won't get as much use, and there's more here than it seems."
The ninth cave set up their camp on the grassy level meadow between the woods and the river close to the small stream. Most people agreed it was a good enough campsite. No other cave was likely to set up their lodges upstream from them and muddy their water. It was too far from the center of activities. Their water would stay clean for their own swimming, bathing, and washing of clothes. The spring-fed stream would provide clear drinking water, no matter how befouled the river might become after hundreds of people used it for their needs. The woods offered shade and firewood, and it appeared small enough that it would not draw too many people in search of the same resources, at least not for a while. Most would head for the larger grove of trees farther downstream. The woods, along with the meadow, also provided wild vegetables, berries, nuts, roots, leaves, and small game. Fish were plentiful in the river, as were freshwater mollusks. The site had many advantages. Its major disadvantage was the distance people would have to walk to reach the area where most of the activities would take place. Some people did think it was too far, primarily those who had family or close friends in other caves that had already made their camp in places they thought were more desirable. Several of those decided to camp with others. In a way, Jandalar was glad. It would make room for Dalinar and the Lanzadanyi when they arrived, if they wouldn't mind being somewhat out of the way. To Ayla, it was perfect. The animals would have a place away from the thronging masses of people, with a meadow for them to graze in. The animals were already the objects of increased attention, which meant, of course, that Ayla was too. She remembered how skittish Winnie, Racer, and Wolf had been when they had first arrived at the Mamutoi gathering. Though they seemed to accept large numbers of people more easily now,
perhaps even better than she did. People spoke out openly, and Ayla couldn't help hearing. They seemed to be especially astonished at how well the horses and the wolf tolerated each other. They actually appeared to be friends. And how well they all responded to the foreign woman and Marthona's son. She and Jandalar rode up the stream and found the idyllic glen with its pond. It was exactly the sort of place they loved. It was so perfect for them, it made them feel it was theirs, though of course anyone could use it, but Jandalar doubted that it would be used much. Most people came to the summer meeting for the group activities and had less need for moments of solitude than Ayla or the animals, or, he had to admit, himself. She was delighted to discover that the dense brush was mostly hazelnut shrubs, one of her most favorite foods. The nuts were not ripe yet, but it looked as if it would be a good crop, and Jandalar was already planning to come back to see if any of the rocks and stones on the slope on the far side of the pond were flint. After the people settled in and began surveying their location, most thought it was a choice spot. Joharan was pleased to have arrived soon enough to lay claim to it. He felt it would have been chosen sooner had there not been a second and somewhat larger tributary that meandered through the middle of the large field that encompassed the summer meeting. Most of the earlier arriving caves had arranged themselves along the banks of that stream, knowing the waters of the river would soon become polluted from overuse. It was the area Joharan first tried, but he was pleased now that he had looked farther afield. Jandalar thought that his conversation with his brother had made him consider looking for a place that would be comfortable for the horses, and mentioned that he appreciated it. Joharan didn't correct him. He knew he had been concerned for the comfort of the people, but perhaps the comment about the animals had stayed in the back of his mind and helped him find the place. He couldn't say it wasn't true, and if it made his brother feel a little indebted to him, he didn't mind. It could be hard enough leading such a big cave, and he never knew when he might have to call upon Jandalar for assistance. Since it was so late, they decided to wait until morning to erect their summer lodges and use their traveling tents that night. Once the camp was established, a few people went to the main area seeking friends or relatives they had not seen since the last summer meeting and to see what was planned for the next day. But most people were tired and decided to stay close by. Many looked over the local area, deciding exactly where they wanted to situate their camp and their individual lodges, and to locate where various vegetation grew, particularly the materials they would need to construct their summer residences. Ayla and Jandalar tethered the horses near the woods and stream, feeling it would be best to keep them secured, more to protect them from people than to restrain them. They would have liked to give them more freedom, but perhaps, after the entire encampment was familiar with them and would not be tempted to hunt them, they could let them wander as they wished, as they did near the ninth cave. In the morning, after they were sure the horses were settled down, Jandalar and Ayla accompanied Joharan as he went to the summer meeting's main area in search of other leaders. Decisions needed to be made about hunting, foraging, and sharing the products of those excursions, and to plan activities and ceremonies, including the first summer matrimonial. Wolf paced alongside Ayla. Everyone had heard of the woman who had an uncanny control over animals, but hearing was not the same as seeing. As they threaded their way between campsites, stares of consternation followed them. And if a person didn't happen to see them approach and was suddenly confronted with the sight, the first response was shock and fear. Even people who knew Joharan and Jandalar gaped instead of calling out greetings. They were walking behind some low bushes, which hid the wolf, when a man approached them.
"Jandalar,